recall the case. The students came for, and the rest of us did too. 00-3562, Donald R. Kitten versus Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development. Representing Donald Kitten is Philip Elliott. Mr. Elliott.
Your Honor, Attorney Phil Elliott, Jr. appears on behalf of the petitioner, Donald R. Kitten, petitioner appellant, Donald R. Kitten.
I know, counsel, that you've asked to sit and that you have been wired.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
And you are wired for sound.
Yes, Your Honor, I apologize for that.
No problem.
I can run 5 miles, but my sciatica, sometimes my left leg fell asleep on the way up here this morning.
No problem. We're delighted to have you, and you may proceed. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The case that is before the court at this point in time deals with the Wisconsin open housing law. I know that you've read the briefs, and I won't get in great detail into the factual situation, although I am going to cite some facts that I consider to be of significance. From a historical point of view, in the legal field of precedent, I feel this is a relatively recent case. The Federal Rehabilitation Act was passed in 1973, and I only refer to that because it's referred to in many cases interpreting the Americans with Disabilities Act, from which this particular case arises. The Americans with Disabilities Act was adopted in 1990. The Wisconsin Open Housing Law, directly involved in this case, was effective September 1st, 1992. So from a historical perspective, this is a relatively new field of law. It is our argument at least, as with any new law or new concept, as rights are granted to certain persons or certain groups, there's a period of time during which there is an orientation as to how many people or how many entities or groups fall within that category. And I think this is the field of law we're dealing with today. Basically, my argument is broken down into three sections. The first is what, in fact, is a disability and what is required in order to bring someone within the definition of a disability under the Wisconsin Open Housing Law or the Americans with Disabilities Act. The second is the direct aspect of this case, because this is what is called a perceived disability case. The administrative law judge in this particular case made a finding at the hearing level that the complainant had not proven that he fit within the category of the law by being disabled, but made a determination that the respondent in that case, or the appellant in this case, made a perception of such disability. And the third section of my argument is whether or not having both the argument for disability but also another reason for an action by a party, or what we would call a legitimate non-discriminatory reason, would therefore have any effect upon the evaluation of the treatment of this case by the court. As I indicated, there are a couple of facts that I think are of great importance in considering this case. The first is that the appellant, Donald Kitten, is a licensed real estate broker in the state of Wisconsin and has been such for about 25 years as of the date. The dates I'm referring to all relate to the date that this incident occurred. At that point, he had been a licensed real estate broker for approximately 25 years, had managed up to 1,000 apartment units at one particular time, and at the time of the incident in question, owned about 160 of his own units and managed those. The initial contact by the complainant in seeking to lease a property from Mr. Kitten was made by telephone from Rogers Memorial Hospital in Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, a hospital that is well known in the community as treating various disorders beyond physical, mental disorders, alcohol, drugs, things of that nature. And Mr. Kitten knew that when he received the first telephone call by virtue of his caller identification. There was then an initial meeting, knowing that the call came from Rogers Memorial. Nonetheless, Mr. Kipton set up a meeting with the complainant and took a rental application. A lease was signed, and there was a discussion relative to the complainant's condition, because the complainant initially indicated that he had an address in the state of Ohio, which was his parents' address. He showed no prior employment. He showed no prior rental history. He showed no income. During the discussion between the parties on the initial meeting, the complainant then conceded that he was hospitalized but was being released, and that his problems consisted of serious issues around food, body image, self-confidence, and self-esteem, and things like that.
Counsel, I have a question. Is it standard practice, and I, since we're, you know, factual content here, to sign the lease, take the payment, but not give a copy of the lease, even though the landlord had not signed it? I understand he was still debating whether he wanted to go through, but is that standard practice not to give a copy of a lease to the prospective tenant?
In my client's case, it was standard practice.
Okay.
He would then mail the lease out after he signed it, conditioned upon receipt of the credit report. At that point of this discussion relative to the self-esteem, Mr. Kipton asked the respondent, "What is your problem, overeating or undereating?" Took the application, and the parties took leave. At this point, the complainant knew there was going to be a credit check, and as I indicated, the initial rental application did not show any source of income, any past rental history, etc. There was a point in time, and keep in mind from a timing frame that we're talking about almost a month passing between the time of this initial meeting and the time that the credit report comes in, about 28 days later, when Mr. Kipton gets the credit report. In the interim, Mr. Kipton is speaking with his sister on one occasion, who is in the medical field, and she indicates that sometimes people who have eating disorders also have suicidal tendencies. And Mr. Kipton expresses a concern toward the next time the parties talk about the possible suicidal tendencies, contending that this is something that he's concerned with relative to the safety of his other occupants in the building. It's uncontradicted testimony in the record that although this is an unusual situation to ask for additional rent up front, Mr. Kipton had done it in the past and would have done it in any other case given the same economic circumstances.
You have sent by a letter dated January 25th, 2002, and in the letter you offer supplemental authority. One of the main cases cited in that letter is the Toyota case, and you go through that holding. I'm wondering, my read of the Toyota case suggests that what the court was dealing with was the first part of the definition, that is, whether or not indeed there was any impairment that substantially limits, as opposed to what I would call the third part of the definition, whether there was perceived impairment. If I'm correct, why does Toyota have anything to do with your argument?
Well, I guess I don't read the case the same as you do, Your Honor. That particular case in paragraph 3 of Justice O'Connor's decision indicates that to qualify as disabled under subsection E, which is the actual disability, one must prove a physical or mental impairment and then finds the type. But in the very next section of the opinion, she does not qualify it by referring to subsection A. She simply says to qualify as disabled, a claimant must further show that the limitation on the major life activity is substantial. And then there are other cases which we have cited in our brief, which indicate that a perceived disability must rise to the level of the actual disability.
Is a sustained...
Now,
I think what you have to do, counsel, is be careful that you don't have your papers covering the microphone.
Okay. I'm sorry. Medical evidence in this particular case was restricted to testimony by the complainant himself, in which he indicated that he had these problems with body image, and a nurse or secretary to a doctor who had been treating the complainant, and that particular person indicated that she was not a medical expert. And also in the brief, you will note that we have referred to the term bulimia nervosa, which is referred to in the diagnosis of the complainant, but I've mentioned it in all of the briefs that I can't find any such medical term.
So it's your position that bulimia or bulimia nervosa, is there a difference between bulimia and bulimia nervosa?
The definitions in the medical dictionaries define bulimia, bulimia. They define conditions which are overeating and undereating, but I cannot find in any medical dictionary or in the proof of facts I cited in our brief in all the pages anything that really defines a term such as bulimia nervosa.
Did the coalition's amicus brief, and my recollection is they indicate that under the DSM-IV, that it's considered a mental illness. Do you agree with that?
No, I disagree with that. I cannot find anything that would support that. I look at the coalition's brief as a fine document that defines philosophically why we should be helping people with handicaps and disabilities. But I see nothing in that brief that really applies to this particular case.
What standard of review? Now, the Court of Appeals said that they used a great weight deference. You know, we have the three standards, due weight, great weight, and de novo. Are we to use a de novo? Is that the suggestion here?
That's my suggestion, yeah. But my argument is that in either event...
Yeah, and why should we? Why shouldn't we give great weight deference to the administrative agency that deals with Wisconsin Open Housing Act 106?
Because I think that we're not dealing with the finding of fact. I think what we're dealing with is the conclusion of law. And at a conclusion of law, it is my position that it's not necessary to give great weight and deference. If the factual situation, I can't argue. Certainly my client's position from the fact situation is totally different than what was found by the administrative law judge, but I think you have to give great deference to that decision. But I don't think you have to do it when she applies the law to those facts.
Counsel, I want to follow up on my question, and I have not looked at the DSM-IV. But page 8 of the amicus says both eating disorders and depression are listed in the DSM-IV and recognized as mental illnesses. I need your assistance. Are you telling me that you disagree with that and that the DSM-IV makes no reference to bulimia? Is that your position?
No, my position is bulimia nervosa. That term, I cannot find it.
Did you look in the DSM-IV?
I did not. I looked in the proof of facts, I looked in medical dictionaries and medical treatises, and I did not find the bulimia nervosa.
Okay. If bulimia nervosa is listed, and I just don't know because I haven't looked, if bulimia is listed in DSM-4 as a mental illness, then would you consider that to be a disability?
No. Not under the ADA or the Wisconsin Open Housing Law. It's a disability, I suppose, in the sense that we all have some disabilities. I don't have any hair. But it's not a disability that affects the daily life to the extent that the case law has defined it. I mean, sure, there's disability, but there's also disability to which this law applies.
Well, here there seemed to be a great deal of discussion in the facts as to what the plaintiff and what the respondent said to each other, but certainly it seems that your client called Ohio. He talked to the mother of this gentleman and asked her if, supposedly, unless this is debated, whether he was suicidal. He asked to speak to the doctor. There was a, I guess what the state is indicating as regarded, or there was a perception of a disability, and that's what you're disagreeing with. You can't just have a perception, you have to have action.
And right. I think that you have to, what you perceive has to be an actual disability. That's the argument that we're making. The call that you're referring to, first there was permission to call the father, and the father was the stockbroker who held the son's accounts. It happened to be that the mother answered the phone, and there were two questions asked, and the mother concedes this. The first was, is your son suicidal? She said he was at one time, but he isn't anymore. And the mother's testimony then goes on to agree that we then moved on to the economic issue. And the complainant himself in his own testimony said the same thing. Once he was satisfied that there were no suicidal tendencies, no danger to other tenants, we then moved on to the next step, which is the economics, which my client contends was the only issue from day one.
What is your argument with regard to perceived disability? You just said what you perceive has to be an actual disability. Now, is it your argument that this, like being bald, is not an actual disability? Or is it your argument that the person has to actually be disabled before the perception, in other words, it has to be read, you're perceived as disabled and you are actually disabled. Which, do you understand the difference I'm making?
Sure.
And which is it?
I understand, Your Honor. No, I don't think that you have to actually be disabled. I think the LaCrosse case shows that. I think that the disability that you perceive, however, must be a disability that falls within the terms of the Act. That's what I'm saying. You must perceive the person to have a disability which would qualify as a disability under the Open Housing Act or the ADA.
Well, here the perception that that your client had was that this man had an eating disorder, and that potentially, or not now, but he had the potential for being suicidal. And there was testimony, although it was by Dina Miller, who was a social worker and the office manager for Dr. Holbrook, and I'm reading out of your opponent's brief on page 5, that he was admitted to an inpatient residential treatment center when the person's eating disorder makes the person not able to function in his or her everyday activities. And that's why I think when Justice Bradley asked you about the Toyota case, Toyota was talking about to qualify as a disability, the impairment must significantly interfere with a function that is of vital importance to everyday life, and certainly eating is an important function.
So, to the extent that you could show that it was an impairment, there are eating cases that are cited, eating disorder cases that are cited in our briefs, where the courts have found that they were not disabilities. I don't think from a proof standpoint or evidence standpoint this case rises anywhere near the level to support the conclusion of law that the administrative law judge gave. Even there's no medical testimony. All of the other cases that are cited, and I might say most of the cases cited in the briefs, and I'm sure you are familiar with that, were decided at the summary judgment level. One of the significance of the Toyota case is that it was a unanimous United States Supreme Court decision. And when Justice O'Connor talks in the Toyota case about daily activities, lifetime activities, she talks about such things as brushing teeth, household chores, bathing, things of that sort. There's no testimony in this record that this man couldn't eat. The testimony was that sometimes he ate too much and sometimes he'd purge himself after he ate, but he was leaving the hospital. I think another very important thing in Justice O'Connor's opinion was when she uses the word that it must be substantially limiting and it must be permanent or of long duration. There is no evidence in this record whatsoever that this man was going to have any problem beyond the day that he left the hospital. He had a college degree, graduated from Boston University, was able to sit through a full day of hearings before the administrative law judge, testified, and was leaving a facility and moving into private living. I see nothing that would fit Mr. Saneem, the complainant in this matter, within the confines of the definition. The Toyota case, which, as you know, is extremely recent, it just seems to be a trend. And I think one of the significant things that's stated in Toyota is when Justice O'Connor indicates that, in effect, we're going to stick with the statutory definition of disability because there is nothing in the ADA that gives the agency any authority to go beyond in making a definition of disability. And then she says, well, the EEOC has defined disability, and I'm not going to make a decision because the parties aren't raising that issue, but she does say that they weren't given that authority. And the same thing is true in Wisconsin law. I can find no authority to define a disability other than in the statute itself. I think the main argument that we're making in this case is that when the law was passed, certain numbers of people tried to fit themselves within the confines of the Act. You've got the United Airlines case, Sutton. You've got the cases where people with high blood pressure, with eye problems and so on, try to fit within the definition of the law. But the cases from 1999 through January of 2002 seem to be going in the opposite direction. They're limiting it. They're pulling more and more people out of the class and saying to the administrative agencies, you do not have the authority to make this definition. The state statute made that definition. Justice O'Connor also refers to the number of people that were under the legislative note when they passed the ADA that would be expected to be covered, and indicates that if we were to extend it out, we would cover, I don't know, I'm not going to use a number because that'd be wrong, but it would be many, many more than was really intended to be covered. And I think the significance of the Toyota case, as I say, is that it follows a series of cases that are reining in the definitions of disability and narrowing them to people who are really severely disabled. And I think
the argument you're making is that bulimia, nervosa, or bulimia is not a severely disabled.
That's correct. All right. That's correct. There's nothing in the record whatsoever to show that it significantly impaired his life. There's nothing in the record that shows that it has any long-standing effects. And then there's another element that was never raised in this case, but it's raised in all the other cases, and that is that there must be a comparison between the condition of the complainant with the general population. You know, how does his disability affect him as compared to the average person in the general population? There is no such comparison anywhere in this particular case.
I'm just referring to the red brief, which is your opponent's brief, seems to have an emphasis on the fact perception as regarded, that's the language in 106 of the statute, but as we look at this through the eyes of your client and what he perceived, and is that the way we should look at this? Or you're saying because your client, regardless of what his perception was, in actuality, bulimia nervosa is not, quote, significant or a major mental illness or a disability?
I think what I'm saying is two things, Your Honor. First, that if my client perceived the complainant to have everything the complainant said, and everything that the doctor's secretary said, and everything that the doctor's letter said, he still could not be guilty of discrimination because what he was perceiving did not rise to the level of an actual disability. I don't think you can be guilty of perceiving someone to be disabled when what you're perceiving, in fact, is not a disability.
Counsel, I see these facts and the arguments as two different perceptions, and your argument in briefs is two different perceptions. One is that your client was concerned that he may have a relapse of bulimia, go back into the hospital, and thus be unavailable to pay rent. The other concern was that, as fed, if you will, by his conversation with his sister, that such a condition is causes depression, and that the depression then will lead to suicidal tendencies. Now, if I focus on the second, that your client thinks that this person is subject to depression and suicide, isn't that a disability?
I don't think that is a disability under the Act, because many people have suicidal tendencies during their lifetime that are controlled by medication, that change with their lifestyle, the Toyota case is very clear that it must be substantially limiting on daily activities based upon comparison with the general population, and it must be permanent or of long duration. But we don't know that he might have had these suicidal tendencies for a week. But from my client's point of view, he wasn't perceiving the complainant to have suicidal tendencies. He was making an inquiry as to whether he did for the permitted purpose of determining whether or not there was a danger to any of his property or other tenants. And he became satisfied, and it's clear from the record, that he wasn't suicidal, and he dropped his claim in this regard and moved on to strictly economic issues. As far as the relapse is concerned, the only concern Mr. Kitten had there was getting his rent. And it was clear that Mr. Kitten was, he spends the winter in a little warmer place than Wisconsin. He goes away for 6 months. All of his leases have no move-out clauses. You can't move out between October 1st and March 31st. He was concerned about getting rent. I would move on.
Thank you, Counsel.
Yes.
Your red light is on, so you have completed your main argument. and you will have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
David C. Rice, Assistant Attorney General, representing the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development.
May it please the Court, my name is David Rice. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I appear in this case on behalf of the Department of Workforce Development. Seated at counsel table with me is Attorney Sandra Graf Radke. She is the attorney who represented Mr. Senemi in the case that gave rise to this appeal. I'd like to start off by correcting a couple of errors, which I'm sure were unintentional on Mr. Elliott's part, but are of some significance. This is not a case that arises under the Americans with Disabilities Act. It is not a case that arises under the Federal Fair Housing Act. This is a case that arises under the Wisconsin Fair Housing Act. And the Wisconsin Fair Housing Act was not enacted after the Americans with Disabilities Act. It was enacted 20 or 30 years earlier. I believe the earliest version of the Fair Housing Act was somewhere back in 1965 or 66. And I believe that the disability, except at that time we called it handicap discrimination provisions of the Fair Housing Act, were added sometime in the mid-60s. I'm not certain of that, but I know that that's when the provisions were added to the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act, which is the companion prohibition against employment discrimination in Wisconsin. Now, that's of some significance because Justice Wilcox asked what the standard review is in this case and what deference the agency ought to get. First of all, with respect to factual questions, there is no dispute that the substantial evidence standard applies, that if the agency's inferences and fact-finding are reasonable, the court must defer. In that respect,
that's under 227.
Under Chapter 227 of the Wisconsin statutes. And insofar as Mr. Elliott identifies an issue as being whether Mr. Kitten was motivated by economic considerations rather than his perception of impairment or disability in this case, that's a factual question that was decided by the agency, by the hearing officer, and must be deferred to by this court, as did the Court of Appeals. There was a diametrically opposed conflict in the testimony. At the end of their relationship, Mr. Senemi says that he was told that if he didn't pay the 6 months rent up front, he wouldn't get the apartment. Mr. Kitten takes the opposite view and says he changed his mind at that point. He anticipated that Mr. Senemi would move in. That issue has been resolved by the hearing officer, and for purposes of this appeal, it's resolved.
Now, so the issue is disability.
Right. So now we turn to the question of law and what should the standard of review then be on questions of law. And I would submit that the Court of Appeals correctly decided that the correct standard of review is great weight deference. And the reason is that the agency hearing officers who decide these cases decide the same types of cases both in employment and in housing. And they've been deciding cases like this for 35 to 40 years. And they struggle in deciding these cases on questions of motivation. They struggle in deciding these cases on whether a person qualifies as being handicapped within the meaning of the act. And they've been doing that for years. And that's why we have these agencies, and that's why they're entitled to great weight deference.
What's the question of law that we're giving great weight deference to?
And I'm not even sure, as I'll go on to suggest, that I'm not sure how much of a question of law is involved here, how much it's mostly factual.
Well, let me just then ask you this. Do you agree with Mr. Elliott that the person need not actually be disabled?
Well, I don't think there's any question about that, Your Honor.
Okay, so that's clear. No
that's
one's
clear.
Debating that. Okay. Now, the next question then is, suppose that you somebody perceives that person is disabled, and let us all agree that it is a disability. Life-threatening, can't work, can't eat, in a coma, whatever it is. Okay. But if you perceive that disability, whether he actually has it or not, and we agree that it's a disability under the statute, then the complainant wins.
No question.
Okay, no question. So let's get to the next one, which is what is supposed here, which is set forth here by Mr. Elliott, that is that the person does not have a disability, and that if he did have this condition, it still would not be actually disabled. Therefore, that he's perceived as having this condition, which is not actually a disability, means that the complainant loses. What's your position on that one, if I've made myself clear?
Yes, you have made yourself clear. That is the correct statement of the law.
Okay. And that is the correct statement of the issue in this case.
Exactly right.
All right. And what's the your position on the law?
Well, this court, a long time ago, back in the mid-'80s, decided the County of La Crosse case, which was an employment case, involved a guy who wanted to be a county deputy sheriff, took a back test, and the test came out suggesting he had a weak back, and based on that information, he was denied employment as a deputy. It turned out later that having taken the test again, that was a false reading on the test, and he didn't have a back problem. This court said in that case that in order to establish a perceived disability, the first test is that you must perceive that the person has a disability, and two, that what is perceived must qualify as a disability within the meaning of the statute. So that case establishes what you've just enunciated as the kind of the framework for deciding this kind of a case.
How does this case before us differ in any way with the La Crosse case?
Well, we don't believe that it does differ in any way. Let me say a word about just a brief statement about the facts in the case, because I think there are some significance, and it probably explains why we're here today and why this case is of any significance to the court. Mr. Senemy was in the Rogers Memorial Hospital for an eating disorder, and the office manager for Dr. Holbrook testified that the person who is in that kind of a residential treatment program comes into that program because they're unable to function in their everyday activities. Their eating disorder has so consumed them and is so powerful that they can't manage outside of a hospital setting. She goes on to say there are medical, physiological, and psychological effects of this condition depending on the severity of the illness. Someone coming into the residential program would be such that their psychological capacity or function would be at a point where they would need this kind of a supportive environment. Mr. Senemy was in this program for 5 months. He ran into the hospital in May and continued into the hospital until September when he was seeking this apartment.
If I could interrupt for a moment, counsel, the agency found that all of that was insufficient to establish bulimia as a disability under the statute, did it not?
I understand that. I'm saying this as background, and I'll...
Well, I understand that, but this relates to the legal question that the chief asked. If it's not a disability, how can it be a perceived disability? If, as a matter of law, those facts, which are in the record, are insufficient to qualify as a disability because they do not substantially limit daily life activities, how can they qualify as a perceived disability? That seems to be a non sequitur.
That was my question.
That's really the crux of the appeal.
Pardon me?
That's the crux of the appeal. Okay,
so if you want us to give deference to the administrative agency, and the administrative agency didn't find this to be a disability under the statute, where are we?
All I'm saying, and I'll make it very brief, was that there's more than enough evidence, including his own testimony, that he left the hospital because he couldn't afford it anymore, not because his doctors had said he was cured. I'm going to answer the question, Your Honor, I promise. And that his condition prevented him from working. Now, that would be another item that would qualify him as disabled were this an actual disability case. What makes this a hard case is the doctor didn't come to the hearing, even though Ms. Radke had his promise that he'd appear. And so we don't have an actual disability, and what we're here for is because all we have is a very limited record on perception of disability. All that we have, to answer your question, is Mr. Kitten's perception that Mr. Senemy would not be able to live on his own and that he would have to be rehospitalized, and that he was suicidal, that he'd run a car in the garage, and asphyxiate himself and put other tenants at risk. That's all there is in the record. I concede that. The question is whether or not those pieces of evidence are sufficient for the hearing officer to reasonably conclude that that would be a disability within the meaning of the statute, because a person who cannot live outside of a hospital setting, who is going to be returned to the hospital or is going to commit suicide, is not a person who, in the words of Toyota, can function in everyday activities.
Well, then how can we support the administrative agency finding that it wasn't a disability? You want us to reverse that finding?
No, what the agency found was that there was no actual disability because there wasn't any medical evidence. What this court said in Connecticut General is if you want to establish a disability as an actual disability, you need medical evidence. And the hearing officer abided by that restriction and said there is no actual disability on this record. I can't find that, despite all of the testimony from Senemi and the social worker and the letter from the doctor, which said that this disability restricts him in his everyday activities. But that's all there is. So we're left with, on appeal, the question of whether the perceived disability, and the evidence is sparse, and the question before you and before the Court of Appeals was, is that sufficient to sustain Mr. Senemi's burden of proving that he was disabled within the meaning of the Act, and on an evidentiary standard, whether there's substantial evidence on review. The Court of Appeals thought that that was sufficient. I can only argue to you that that's what the agency's position is, and that we suggest that it's reasonable. There's nothing else in the record. I reread the entire record last evening, and it's nothing else in there.
This case is really very different from the LaCrosse case, because in that case, the plaintiff didn't have a back problem.
Yeah, but for purposes of perception, it doesn't matter whether you have it or don't have it.
What makes this case different and what makes it hard is that everybody agrees that Mr. Senemi has bulimia, and we have an agency finding that as a matter of law, that's insufficient, and in fact, that's insufficient to qualify as a disability. So under those circumstances, with that sort of a finding, how can we say that it doesn't qualify, if we accept what the agency said, it doesn't qualify as a disability because it doesn't substantially limit his life activities, and there was insufficient proof of that. How can we turn around and say, but there is sufficient proof to say it qualifies as a perceived disability? In other words, if something isn't a disability in the first place, how can it be a perceived disability? Not whether he suffers from it or not, because everybody agrees he has this disorder.
Well, maybe I'm not understanding the difficulty you're having, because I'm sorry if I'm not. But
well, let's take the Bald case.
But there's two of them. I mean, there's two different standards here. If you don't establish the facts to establish an actual disability, then you have a failure of proof and you don't prevail. What if the landlord here didn't perceive anything about his bulimia, but perceived that he wasn't able to work because he didn't hold a job, and perceived that he would not be able to work, that was based on his hospitalization, and that he really didn't know why he was hospitalized. You know, that would be a different situation, and the question there again would be whether or not there was a perception of a disability, even if it's wholly unsubstantiated by the record. In LaCrosse, the guy had no problems with his back. He was an athlete. He was fully capable of performing the job. It was a misperception on the part of the hiring authority. I think the two cases are parallel.
But look, in LaCrosse, does the court say that this weakness of the back is a disability or
yes,
a handicap under the statute?
It could be.
And that was good enough in LaCrosse.
Right.
Well, then it seems to me that your answer should be that what you need is a perception of a disability.
Exactly.
We agree on that. That's good enough. But that, and you don't have to be actually disabled, we agree on that. But that if the person perceives that this is a major disability that is fits within the statute, that's good enough, even though a doctor might say no, it is not that kind of disability.
Right.
Pardon me?
Yes, that's right.
But see, that's not quite the answer I thought you gave me before. I thought the answer you gave me before was that that which is perceived as being disabled has to, as a matter of law, be disabled. So that, let's take a baldness case. Let us just assume that baldness is not a disability, but I'm going to hire him. And I say, I don't want any lawyer that's bald. I want a lawyer that has a full head of hair, because I think clients trust people with hair. And that I think, not only should they have a full head of hair, but I would strongly, I think that they're disabled from practicing law, unless they're a little gray, because clients trust people who are older and mature and have experience. Therefore, I'm not going to hire you if you are bald and don't have some gray. Okay? That, to me, is a criteria for hiring, right? I perceive you being bald as having a great disability for employment. Okay? So the perception is there. And that you are actually bald, that's taken care of too. Is that would that fit under the statute? I know we're dealing with housing here, but I can change it to housing. Would that fit under the statute? Because we agree that a reasonable person does not view, and a reasonable doctor does not view hair have as having anything to do with the practice of law. Right? If I substituted sex or race, you know, you'd be quite clear. So what do you say?
Well, I would say that wouldn't fit within the definition. Right. That would not come within the definition of the statute.
So even if I perceive it that way, it's not good enough.
No, because you wouldn't be perceiving he had a disability. I mean, I think maybe the closest example that this court has dealt with was the American Motors with the case of the person who was 5'1", his shortness and disability, and I thought what the court said in LaCrosse, I think they referenced that, was a distinction, that what you perceive must be a disability. Isn't that if you perceive that somebody's short, that wouldn't qualify. If you perceive that somebody's bald, that wouldn't qualify. If you perceive that somebody can't do the self-care necessary to live on one's own, within the Americans with Disabilities Act, and the Fair Housing Act, and the Fair Employment Act, that's the kind of disability that would qualify whether or not the person was able to take care of himself.
It seems to me that the confusion here rests with whether or not the standard is a subjective or an objective standard. And that the second issue. And as I had written it down from counsel, he said that the perceived disability must be a disability within the act. Now that sounds to me like an objective standard. Is that correct? Do you believe? Because you could say that the perceived disability must be a disability that the person doing the perceiving believes is a disability within the act, even though it's not. So, does the perceived disability have to be a disability within the act?
I think that's what you said in LaCrosse, and I think that would be binding in this case as well.
Even though the administrative judge says it's not a disability because you didn't have enough proof, you didn't have a doctor's certificate.
The hearing, as I understand the decision, the examiner said that you're not disabled. You haven't proven that you're disabled. What you've proven is that what Mr. Kitten perceived, if you had those things, if you couldn't take care of yourself, if you had to go back to the hospital, if you were suicidal, those things would qualify as a disability, if that were the issue.
Mr. Rice, your opposite number, Mr. Kitten here, is not a particularly sympathetic figure, but I think the court would be very concerned about the test that would be written in the opinion. I mean, it would be seem to me almost open-ended. How do you address that question?
Well, I think that the problem is that the record is not very helpful to us, but I don't think that that should be a barrier to formulating the test. I think the test can be based on a combination of lacrosse and Toyota. I think that the test would be, does the landlord in this case perceive that the person has something? Just call it something for now. That's the first question. And then the second question is that something, a physical or mental impairment, which substantially limits a major life activity? The question in this case is the perception that someone can't handle the self-care necessary to have everyday living.
What about a sexual predator?
Sorry?
What about a sexual predator?
Uh-huh.
Suppose I'm a landlord and I perceive a sexual predator as being a person who simply cannot live safely with his neighbors, is unable to control his emotions, probably can't work because if people know about him, they don't want to employ him. Is that a disability? I would say this person can't function in society. Now, how would you respond to that?
Well, I think that the way you've defined it, that he has emotional problems that preclude him from being able to hold employment, the person would qualify under the definition of disability, and therefore would qualify under the definition of perceived disability.
So that a landlord who turned down a sexual predator would be prosecuted by the Department of Workforce Development?
Well, he may be prosecuted, and in a sense, that's a kind of a criminal law term. He may have a complaint pursued against him, but he, in that case, arguably would have a defense, which Mr. Kitten might have had here had he elected to make that his defense. That is, the statute provides that you don't have to rent some to someone who's going to be a threat to other tenants. And if Mr. Kitten had established that as a defense, his position in the hearing was, no, I was satisfied with the explanations I received that he wasn't suicidal, so I wasn't concerned about that any longer. But to answer your question, there is a defense available to the landlord in the case hypothetical that you pose.
That could never be proven in the case of a sexual predator, though, because by definition, a sexual predator under Chapter 980 who is released back into the community has been found by a court to be safe for release back into the community and to pose no such threats.
I don't know if I assume that the two statutes would be construed harmoniously and that would be the result. I'm not enough of an expert on sexual predator law to know whether the determination in the civil/criminal commitment process part of it would be the equivalent of the Civil Fair Housing Act, but I defer your expertise. I don't know the answer to that.
Counsel, tell me if I'm wrong in my interpretation of the administrative law judge's opinion. As I understand it, the administrative law judge is saying, in essence, look, bulimia can be a disorder, an impairment that substantially limits major life activity. Bulimia can be that. That here the complainant did not put forth sufficient medical evidence regarding the exact nature, extent, severity, and long-term prognosis of this complainant's bulimia for the administrative law judge to determine whether or not, in this case, bulimia presented such a substantial impairment. However, then the law judge goes on to say that, but the complainant showed that the respondent, by his actions, believed that the complainant's eating disorder did cause a substantial limitation on life activities. Is that your interpretation of the administrative law judge's conclusion?
Yes, but only indirectly, because I think what she says in her decision isn't that the perception of the eating disorder was sufficient to prevail. I think what she said was the perception that the eating disorder will have effect of substantially limiting his self-care ability, meaning he'll have the relapse and go back to the hospital, or that it has the, looking to the question of suicide, that he would be unable to live essentially successfully.
Does the administrative law judge make a determination that under certain circumstances, bulimia would qualify as a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities?
I don't believe that the hearing examiner makes that determination, but I think that it's without doubt that that's the truth. And as I read this record, the only thing lacking was the doctor to come and testify about the impact of the eating disorder on Mr. Senemi and others and on their daily life activities. He testified that eating disorder is a lifelong problem, that it prevented him from working, that he had to spend his time concentrating on his disability. Clearly, I don't think there's any question that we wouldn't be here. I submit we wouldn't be before this court if the only question were whether the evidence were sufficient to establish an eating order disability with appropriate medical evidence. What makes this case difficult and why we're here was the doctor didn't come to the hearing, and so we're struggling with this question of perceived disability.
Well, on page 109 of the appellant's appendix, the conclusion of law is number two. The complainant is a person with a disability within the meaning of WOHA.
Okay. Yes.
If we were just left with that and all of the other matters in the findings, we'd probably be okay. The problem arises on page 111, as I understand this. So the administrative law judge in her memorandum or her memorandum decision, this lack of medical information prevents the administrative law judge from finding the plaintiff has a record of such impairment so that she can't find actual disability, right? But we agree he doesn't have to have an actual disability.
Right. What she's saying there is she can't find a record of an impairment, which is the third possibility, which we haven't talked about this morning.
All right, but we don't need an actual disability.
You
right?
don't.
Okay. So where does she say that it's irrelevant whether he actually has it because bulimia as such, severe bulimia, is a disability? That's all we have to do is find something that she says bulimia is a disability under the statute. Whether he has it or not is irrelevant, right?
Right.
You agree with my statement of the law?
Yes.
Okay. Where does she say that? Anywhere?
Well, I think that the last sentence on page 111 is where she states her conclusion, which has been affirmed by the Circuit Court and by the Court of Appeals, which is that it was respondent's belief, Mr. Kitten's belief, that Senemi's eating disorder would prevent him from being able to live on his own and take care of himself without further hospitalization or attempts in his life.
My problem with that is like the bald example. I believe baldness is a qualification or a disqualification. But nobody else seems to go along with me. And so here, that whole paragraph deals with the belief of Mr. Kitten. It doesn't say as a matter of law, manner of interpreting this statute, bulimia is such a disorder. That's the problem.
I don't believe that she's finding that bulimia is the disorder here. I think what she's saying is that there's a perception that he couldn't do certain major life activities. Being bald doesn't relate to your ability to do major life activities. it may restrict you from a particular employment because of the nature of that employment, or at least the employer's perception about the qualification. But here we're talking about what the rules of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and the Federal Department of Health, Education, Welfare, whatever it is now, Department of Health, the rules include being able to take care of oneself, self-care, within the definition of the kind of major life activities which, if impacted or are perceived to be impacted significantly, qualify as a disability within the meaning of the Act. The Court of Appeals in this case cited one of the state statutes. I believe it was, well, it's cited in my brief, but it includes self-care within the major life activities. So in concluding, the department would request that you apply the evidentiary and legal deference that the agency is entitled, to which the agency is entitled. I understand that the facts in this case unfortunately leave us without as sound a footing for making law, perhaps, as you'd like to in this case. But I don't really believe that you're making law or that you're establishing a new standard. I think what you're doing is taking the concept that you developed in the La Crosse case and your need to articulate that and clarify and apply that in the context of this fair housing case.
Let me just repeat the question that Justice Prosser asked you, and that is, what do you, if you were writing this opinion, what would you write as the standard of law that will be applied here?
Well, I think that I would adopt the opinion of the Court of Appeals because I think they did a really good job.
Okay, what particular language do you like from the Court of Appeals?
I'm looking at the reported opinion, 247, Wisconsin.
What paragraph?
Paragraphs 29 through 31, I think, is the guts of their analysis. The end of paragraph 30. There's no great leap for us to interpret the WOHA as protecting a person who is regarded by a landlord as having an impairment that substantially limits major life activities, even if, in fact, he or she does not have such an impairment.
That's the language. And that doesn't take care of my bald case?
I think it does take care of your bald case because I don't think that baldness substantially limits a major life activity.
Okay.
Being able to live on one's own is a major life activity.
And baldness doesn't here because even if I have that view towards lawyers, everybody else is not going to have that view, so you can get a job.
That's good.
Pardon me?
That's great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rice. Mr. Elliott, I'd hire you, by the way. That's just...
Excuse me, Aaron?
I said I'd hire you, regardless of the air.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. With the nose to... Thank you. I would just like to say that it was not my intent to mislead the court and say that the Open Housing Act was passed in 1992. I said it in its current form was effective in September of 1992. The reason I refer to the ADA, and I fully realize this is not a case under the ADA, but that's where we draw our references from and the authorities, and it's been stated that the courts follow the federal court decisions when interpreting the Wisconsin similar similar laws. Another thing that's come up during the argument of counsel is the bulimia. Keep in mind that while there's been questions asked by the court about bulimia, the word bulimia first came up after the complaint was filed. Our position is that in a perceived disability case, what you must perceive is a disability. All Mr. Kitten knew at the time that he asked for additional rent from the complainant was that the complainant alleged that he had an eating disorder. He didn't have the benefit of a diagnosis. The word bulimia, that came up after the whole legal process started. Mr. Kitten did not have any, it was never transmitted to him that there was bulimia. I think that what counsel, or two things that counsel argued, support the position of the appellant in this case. He uses one example, what if you perceive someone to not be able to work? Is that or is that not a perceived disability? Well, it may be, but there's no indication that Mr. Kitten perceived that he couldn't work. What if he, what if the he perceived was a real disability? The question, and he didn't. What Mr. Kitten perceived was only what was there. The lacrosse case, there was a perception of a disability. There was no disability, but what the employer perceived. And unfortunately, all these cases are employment cases. We don't have any housing cases that I can find, both federal and state. But in the lacrosse case, what the person would have had the perception been correct, would have been a real disability. I guess all we're saying here is that Mr. Kitten could not have perceived anything more than what had been transmitted to him, and what had been transmitted to him did not constitute a disability under the Act. In addition, I would stress the trend of the court decisions that seem to be narrowing that definition down, and when Justice O'Connor uses such language as bathing, brushing teeth, we're not talking about whether or not somebody may have to go back in the hospital after a month and come back out again. We're talking about the words significant and permanent and long term. And I don't think there's any way that the complainant in this case fits within that category, and Mr. Kitten cannot be found to have discriminated by perceiving something that does not fit within the category of a disability. Both my client and myself, thank you very much for allowing us to argue this case before you.
Well, thank you, counsel. I hope that both of your briefs indicated that oral argument would not be necessary, but I think that maybe you proved that it was necessary. Thank you. That concludes our hearing on 003562 Kitten versus Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development.